Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Thriving in space. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. If humans are going to travel farther from home to places like the Moon and Mars, there's a lot of work to be done. That's according to a new report that outlines a vision for biological and physical science research in space. We'll speak with Rob Farrell, one of the study's authors, about the next decade of research. Plus, the new book, The Six, gives us a glimpse into the lives of the first female astronauts. We'll speak with author Lauren Grush about the book. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? The Decadal Survey of Biological and Physical Sciences highlights goals that surround space exploration and research. The survey is from opinions of scientists on what the next 10 years of scientific development should be and what are the current fields of interest. A new report on the direction of physical and biological sciences is out now, and here to talk about the report's finding is Rob Farrell, Distinguished Professor and Assistant Vice President for Research at the University of Florida. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Always great to chat with you, Rob. We've got a new report on the Decadal, but before we get to the substance of that report, let's talk about the Decadal itself. What is it, and what is the process that goes into creating this?
For me, and I think for many of us scientists, the Decadal process is one of the keenly exciting ways in which scientists get to have input, get to have a real voice in policy. In other words, we as scientists, and here working for the National Academies, we get to have a voice on what the future ought to look like from a science perspective. And that's big. That's big in our world, to be able to influence the directionality of our world and to do so with a collective voice. So yeah, the process of putting together the Decadal is a 3-year process involving, when all is said and done, probably close to 100 scientists in our discipline from around the country, all organized by the National Academies.
And this, in essence, kind of drives discovery and research for the larger agencies, right? That's the plan, right? You're trying to steer the ship.
Yeah, absolutely. And not to put sort of too much power in the hands of science, we don't necessarily get to steer the ship. We get to ask where the ship ought to go. And then the agency, in this case NASA, but and also in this case other agencies and even the commercial sector, get to look to that destination and say, how do we help get there? So in other words, we get to pick the destination, and I don't mean that we get to pick the moon, but we get to pick the scientific destinations, the things we need to know in the space world of biological and physical sciences. And then that sort of gives marching orders to the agencies to figure out how to make that.
All right, let's stay with the ship analogy, Rob. And in this report on biological and physical sciences, you know, the report says if we as humans are going to chart new courses and go to new places like the moon and Mars, there's a lot of work to be done, right? Tell us a bit about some of the work that needs to be done according to this report and where that science and discovery should be focused.
As you well know, the number of people and the number of person hours and person years in space has reached a point where, I mean, quite honestly, 10 years ago, I'm not sure any of us would have guessed that there'd be this much personal presence of the human species in space. And how many launches do we have? It used to be you had to wait to find one and hope that you could get there to see it. Now, if you just drive the KSC, you're very likely to see one. It's happening all around us. One of the big recognitions of this Decadal study is that we now find ourselves in this really real low Earth orbit ecosystem. And we find ourselves, for real, thinking about going back to the moon. In fact, we've already sent our ships there, and pretty soon we're going to send our people there. So this basically lays down the gauntlet to science to understand how to do that safely and respectfully in a way that's useful, that's sustainable, and that turns those exploration endeavors into activities that are useful, not only for exploration, but for things back here on Earth that can use that space technology. That's a long way around to getting to the following answer. And that is that we've outlined a series of scientific questions that need to be answered. We haven't been prescriptive with where they need to be answered, but they outline a series of things that basically need to be better understood, even well understood, before we seek to put that many people in that many places in the outer space system.
And it can't be lost that we're having this conversation on the day NASA astronaut Frank Rubio sets a U.S. spaceflight record of something like 335 days on orbit. A trip to a place like Mars, they're going to be in space far longer than that, right? What do we know about kind of the effects on the human body? And what do we still need to do to make this, as you say, well understood for human participants to spend more time in space?
Let me start by saying that the report deals with not just what we need to know about humans, but what we need to know about everything humans will take and want to do in space or on their way to Mars. So this includes the microbes we'll take along with us, either intentionally or by accident. It will include our physical systems, our 3D printers, our reclamation systems. It could include our plants. It'll include any animals we're going to take. It's basically the spaceship ecosystem that we need to understand. The study basically embraces the notion that there are, especially for long-term things in space, things being people and the things we take with us that are not animate, there are a lot of things yet to be understood. And I'll give you a couple of real quick examples. One of them is a keen recognition that genetics plays a role in the ability of biology. So we have found out that some astronauts do better than others. We have found that there are some genetic things that happen with the viruses we take with us. And therefore, the genetic diversity of the spaceflight participants, whatever species they are, needs to be more deeply understood, especially as we take more and more people of varying types, sizes, shapes, and other sorts of diversity into space. We need to, as scientists, have a better understanding of what that genetic diversity brings as far as opportunities or issues to any spaceflight travelers, again, of any species. So that's one big thing. The diversity of life. Another thing is that we have gotten really pretty good at understanding a bit about how things change when one goes from the Earth to space. We are getting pretty good, but we need to do a lot more of what happens over the long term of that biological system or physical system in space. In other words, the long-term maintenance, what we would call living and working in space, is basically a new concept. We're not going up there for short times anymore. We're going up there for long periods of time. And so basically the middle part of the Decadal's recommendations has everything to do with long-term living and working in space. Not just going and coming back, but the long term of being there.
Those ambitions are very close on the timeline. When you talk with these agencies like NASA, you know, we've got humans going to the moon in the next few years, establishment of permanent or semi-permanent bases on the moon, and then, you know, Mars always seems to be a decade or two away. Is that enough time to figure all this stuff out, Rob? Are you optimistic that the science community is up to this task?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a firm believer in science, and I'm a firm believer that the task's laid out. And so I'm gonna brag on the process here. The National Academies basically put 70 of the brightest minds in this business together for 3 years to work out this process. And what we all did was examine inputs from over 250 opinion papers that were gathered from the broader scientific community, over 60 papers that were inputs on what large science campaigns might look like over the coming 10 years. And then we bracketed all of that together with a very clear notion of what could be accomplished within the next 10 years. So part of our job was to include in the report, in the survey, a very cognizant opinion on what could be accomplished and what could be largely accomplished within the coming decade. So part of our job was to put ourselves in a position where we could succeed as a community in understanding what needs to be done. So the answer is yeah, absolutely it's doable. We've made it that way.
Another aspect of this report, Rob, that was really interesting to me is the fact that you included a section on public trust and global cooperation. Why is this so important over the next decade of discovery?
Well, there's one very concrete example as to why, and that is one of the most richly informative scientific platforms in human history, the International Space Station, is a direct result of international cooperation. It's a direct result of recognition of the beauty of working as a whole of community. And we're going to lose that at some point in time, likely within the decade of this decadal study. That's going to go away and it will become some new endeavor, commercial LEO destination, other international destinations. But it absolutely highlights the fact that a lot of good came from international cooperation and broad thinking about how we as a species get the answers we need to have. So I would say that's recognized and actually a key part.
Finally, Rob, you know, what's next? Where does the report go and what can we expect in the implementation of this?
Well, one of the things I think you can absolutely expect is that the report is a doggedly positive outlook about where science has come in the last 10 years since the beginning, basically the early beginnings of the space station era. It celebrates the amount of science that's been done in space and the sort of unheard of back then idea that we'd already be doing commercial work in space. We'd be considering, you know, business models that depend on being in space. That's really astounding when you think about it. So the past decade came so far that this decadal study is a celebration of that and a recognition that we're on a sort of a exponential trajectory in the amount of work that can be done and should be done in space. So it's a celebration of where we are. The major thing is that this is just such a cool way for the whole of government to get the ideas, impressions, goals of science as a big part of moving agencies forward. And in this case, NASA. I can't think of a cooler thing for a space scientist to be able to do than to have input on where space science is going.
Still to come, The Six, a dive into the story of the first women astronauts. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. In 1978, six women forever changed the space industry when they joined the U.S. space program. Catherine Sullivan, Shannon Lucid, Ray Seddon, Anna Fisher, Sally Ride, and Judy Resnick were the first women selected when NASA opened the astronaut application to everyone, regardless of race or gender. The new book, The Six, The Untold Stories of America's First Women in Space, explores their identities and how they each helped the space program evolve into what it is today. Lauren Grush is the author of that book and also a space reporter for Bloomberg News. She spoke with Are We There Yet's Marian Summerall about The Six.
Well, Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's talk about this book a little bit. First of all, I love it. It's amazing.
Thank you so much.
When you open the book, you read the line, "To the women who look up and dream of more." Tell me about why you picked that specific statement.
Well, It was just very important to me to pick a story that centered women. Just a little bit about me. I myself, you know, am a woman, obviously, in the male-dominated industry. While there are many great female journalists in the space journalism world, you know, when I first got started, I still felt a bit outnumbered. And so finding more women that I could relate to was really important to me. And, you know, I've always dreamed of writing a book, but when it comes to reporting on space, it still feels like a very male-dominated industry. And so it was very important to me to center women's voices. And so when I was thinking of, you know, who I wanted to dedicate the book to, it really kind of centered around that sentiment of the women that I have associated myself with in my life and the ones that I've grown to know by reporting on this field and also in the space industry themselves. They are the people that kind of inspire me and give me hope. And so that's what I was hoping to give back to them with that dedication.
You kind of led me to the next question that I had, which talk about the research that went into this book and going through the articles and the archives.
Yeah, a great part of researching this book was there's a very rich history that's available if you know where to look. NASA did something very fantastic, which is this oral history project. So they were able to go back and talk with many of the astronauts, many of the executives and officials that were working during this time. And they were very open and honest with what the missions were like at the time, what the culture was like at the time. But a lot of the research also stemmed from going through old news articles in the archives, magazine articles. And so I really got a vivid account of how the press, our media ancestors, covered the women during this time. And that was probably the most eye-opening experience, because I think that really painted a picture of just how they were viewed, how people thought about them at the time, how they thought this was such an anomaly at the time. And, you know, I must give forgiveness for the press at the time in the 70s and 80s, because they weren't necessarily so enlightened in their questions and how they portrayed the women. But they definitely, there was a lot of coverage of them at the time. Another great resource was Johnny Carson. I went through his archives as well. Also a great representation of the jokes that were being made at the time. Not so, you know, I don't think anyone would be laughing at them these days. And if you go back and listen to them, they started groaning after a while. So yeah, it was a lot. And then of course, NASA has a lot of great archival information on the missions that the women actually did. There's some great air to ground transcripts that I went through. Just a lot of great, you know, a variety of media that I was able to sort through and to really piece together a whole portrait of what these women's lives were like during this period of time.
It seems like you really took, you know, so much amount of time to use so many different elements of researching for this book. Did it make you feel more connected to these six women when you were going through the research? And then when you did start writing the actual book, you know, how did that kind of go into play?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I really loved the most was obviously talking with the women and the TFNGs that I was able to talk to. It really did. And the TFNGs, just to relate, stands for the 35 New Guys. That was the astronaut class in which these women were selected. For those that were able to talk to me from that era, from that astronaut class, you know, it was fantastic. It really did feel like I was a fly on the wall sometimes in the 80s and the late 70s, getting to hear about their training, the stories that they remember, and also hearing the different stories from different perspectives. You know, certain people remember it one way, whereas other people remember it the other way. It is just a fascinating dive into how memory works and what stands out to people versus what doesn't. I really did feel like I got to be like a little ghost in the room during TFNG training back in the day. And it really did seem like such a fascinating and vibrant class to be a part of. And so I really am honored and touched that they shared so much with me.
And now that we've kind of talked a little bit about the background and, you know, how you're connected and through your research, I did want to talk a little bit about the first chapter, But Only Men Can Be Astronauts. And it talks about Margaret Ray Seddon not only wanting to follow her mother's path, but pursuing a path in STEM as a surgeon. You know, you made that kind of connection to the media of how the media has changed, but Do you think that women today feel the same struggle when it comes to STEM and specifically having a space-related career like Margaret did?
I think that's what's so great about these women, right, is because hopefully because of their experience and what they went through, the women today don't have to deal with the same kinds of struggles. Obviously, there are so many things that we're still fighting for today, but that is why I ultimately wanted to write this book, is because in my own life, I think about the women who came before and have made it easier for me. That's ultimately what pioneers are for. And what I found fascinating was that for the women themselves, depending on how old they were or what generation they were in at the time that they applied to be an astronaut, they had vastly different experiences of sexism and chauvinism. For instance, Shannon Lucid was slightly older than the other women when they applied. And the amount of, you know, chauvinism she had to deal with when she just wanted to work. All she wanted to do was to have a job that was in her field. I mean, she went to college and grad school for chemistry. You know, just having people take her seriously, she was just constantly told no. And so I really hope that because of the strides that we've made and the women that have made it easier for us, that women don't feel that same barrier that they might have felt in the earlier days. Of course, I do know, like I said, there's still a long way to go in terms of reaching parity. And I'm sure that has some significant effects when it comes on women feeling comfortable in male-dominated workplaces. But like I said, I think there's a lot more efforts that are being made today with certain fellowship programs that encourage women to go into STEM and into space and science.
The book gives you that element of, hey, these women went through these struggles, and now today there are more opportunities that are around.
Oh, I was just going to point out, you know, one story that I like to bring up is like when I first went out to Cape Canaveral for a rocket launch, I was probably one of the younger people in the room. I was also one of maybe two or three women who were covering that launch. And so I very much felt extremely out of my element when I was there. I felt like more eyes were on me than normal. You know, it's just, it can be so isolating when you don't feel like there's anyone you can relate to in the room. And so that's what I really hope is helpful with this book is, you know, they had to go through it so that we didn't have to. And, you know, it's sad that that's the way that it is. And obviously, you know, this should have happened way earlier, but it is, you know, somebody did have to come first. And that's, you know, what this book is about.
That's also what I gathered from the book, and kind of your style of writing is kind of showing that progression. Another part of the book with losing Judy in the Challenger explosion. I mean, it was devastating. It was heartbreaking, and how each of the six did their part to keep the space program alive. Can you give insight into why you think it was their priority to keep it alive and to hold different people accountable?
Well, I think when it comes to something you love, you can also want it to be better too. And I think that was true for Sally. You know, she loved the space program. She had great moments with the space program, but at the same time, I think you do have such an affinity for something. You can also see the cracks and the places where things can improve. And so, I think for Sally, it was just really important to, you know, not let the astronauts' lives not lead to change. You know, obviously, she wanted to make something positive out of it. And I just think that's a great anecdote about, you know, just it shows how the women did stick up for each other in times when they really needed it. You know, one thing that I found interesting about the book is that I went into it thinking that, oh, they were all going to be just like best friends. And, you know, they are obviously super supportive of each other. And while they were, and they did come together as a unit, you know, they weren't like this girl group that I think maybe the press thought they might have been. And that's completely natural, right? What I really loved was that Sally and Judy were particularly close. And so really was a very touching moment for Sally to be able to help incite change from the accident that Judy tragically lost her life in.
You know, they all came together to support something that they really loved and seeing the cracks in it and making sure they speak out. And on the back of the book, it's a note from you saying that this story needs to be told. And when someone reads their stories and reads this book, what is the main message you want the reader to take away? You know, what would you as the author want that to be?
So it might sound really silly, but ultimately, I really just want people to come away realizing that the women were just people, you know? I think there probably is a lot of focus to kind of build them up as these heroes. And while they are in such a way, they really were just trying to do their jobs. And they just happened to be the first ones of their gender to do it. And so that's why I actually really, truly loved writing the chapters of their spaceflights, because it really, that was less about them as women, and it was really more just about them as astronauts performing their job and why they love to do what they do. And so I want people to take away, yes, you know, there are interesting aspects of this book where, you know, there were some, I guess, culture clashes and also some people that weren't so, you know, accepting of them. And while I did want to highlight that, I ultimately wanted to just, you know, just paint portraits of women who happened to be slotted into these pioneering roles. And that's ultimately what I want for us, you know, moving forward. And then that was what also the Six wanted too. You know, the last thing they wanted was anyone highlighting their gender. They were all about being part, like one of the guys, essentially. They didn't want to be seen as like the girl astronaut or the woman astronaut. And I think that's ultimately what we all want as well. Now, as we move forward, I think, you know, we've kind of evolved in our thinking when it comes to this sort of thing. I think we're at a stage where we can celebrate being women and being different, but at the same time, not letting that be a hindrance in terms of how we can move forward in our lives and careers. And so, yeah, that's ultimately what I hope people take away.
If I were to also say, what did I take away? That'd be my statement as well.
Well, I just think this book is pretty timely because of where we are in our nation's space program right now. You know, for those that might not be following it, you know, NASA is in the midst of its Artemis program to send people back to the moon. And one of the stated goals of that program is to send the first woman to the surface of the moon. And I think that they haven't selected her yet, but when they do, you know, obviously she's going to get a lot of attention, similar to way the Sally Ride did when she launched on STS-7. But I'm hopeful that because we've had, you know, the Six have paved the way and have made it easier, the questions that they will get, that she will get, and the attention that she will get will be much more evolved and less of a spectacle than when Sally Ride flew. And so I think that's just a testament to the women that came before. And, you know, hopefully she'll have them to thank for that.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you've got more space coverage online, visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.